Okay, for this evening's talk, I'm going to take a big risk. Actually, this is not being live streamed, so I'm a little bit of okay. Because somebody asked me, as usual, before I come in here, have I decided on this evening's talk subject? And I hadn't. And they said there was something which was troubling them as a Buddhist, and that was, how does a Buddhist relate to something like Anzac Day? Because now this is a very important day, you know, here in Australia. And many of you here, you know, are not from born in many countries. And sometimes, how does a Buddhist relate, you know, to this celebration which happens in many countries in the world, you know, either on Anzac Day or Remembrance Day? And what is the Buddhist attitude, you know, to military, to wars, to fightings, to conflict? And it's something which always bothers a Buddhist, simply because of, you know, one of the basic precepts of Buddhism, which is known by everybody, is its non-violence. You know, a Buddhist shouldn't even be able to kill a fly, you know, not to swat a mosquito. And then what do we do, you know, if we are called to go to a war? Or if in our past there's been a conflict, and we live, you know, amongst, we may know many people who have had to fight in that war and maybe died. And on a day like today, how should we relate, you know, as Buddhists, you know, to something where we want to respect, you know, traditions, you know, we want to respect people who did sacrifice a lot. Why they sacrificed that? If any of you have known soldiers, sometimes they join up for so many different reasons. And most of the reasons why people, you know, ordinary people, put on a uniform and go to war, they don't have high ethical reasons why they do this. A lot of time it's the culture, the circumstances of the time give them very little choice. I remember just people who fought in the Vietnam War, which is, you know, my generation, and not from UK, but people I met from, especially United States. I remember just this one fellow, he was a monk, and he was actually a US indigenous Indian, I think Cherokee. And his father took him aside one day and he said, you know, you're not going to college, to university, so I'll give you three choices, son. Army, Air Force, or Navy. And that's what he had to do. He had no choice, you know, because of the pressure, you know, from his community and from his family. And I think that from what I remember, because, you know, I'm 62, I do remember just my immediate parents, uncles, aunties, you know, they were in the Second World War in England. And so you do have some personal experience of what happened over there. I remember my mother and grandmother telling me that the house where they lived in London, you know, terraced houses, you know, that you can hear the neighbours through the walls. The house next door got a direct hit from a bomb, and their neighbours were instantly killed. And my mother was very lucky just to escape with a lacerated arm, with blood running all over the place. They survived. And I remember my grandmother, this was just how I grew up. Whenever there was a thunderstorm, whatever we were doing, she would stop and she would go and sit in the stairs, because that's where she would go for safety during the time of the Blitz in London in the 40s. And it was no post-traumatic stress disorder, although it was never called that in the time. And she would sat there until the thunder and lightning was over, and then she would come and join the rest of the family again. It was the scars of the war. And so you know exactly what happens. And so the first thing I would say that you, now even though as a Buddhist, you know, that you really start to feel, please, can there be some other alternatives, you know, to this conflict? And I'll be talking about this afterwards. But nevertheless, you still respect those people who basically did not have much of a choice, who had to join up for one reason or the other and fight in those terrible conflicts, you know, and the trauma, which what people see in a war, And sometimes the people who live suffer more than those who died. If ever, you know, you come across people who are wounded in a war, it's a very terrible situation. They're usually young people where the whole future life has been taken away from them. And there are people who are maimed, wounded, blinded. And it gives you such a sense of, do we really have to keep doing this? So I think when we have something like an Anzac Day, it's not a celebration of a war. It's almost like a sense of acknowledgement of what's been taken away for many of the people who had to fight in that war. Although the one thing which, you know, soldiers tell you, that even though they saw so much pain, there was also a sense of meaning in their lives. Now, unfortunately, that most of us, we haven't got clear directions of what we need to do, what we want to do in our lives. We wander around with so many different sort of goals in our life, trying to find a meaning. Someone like myself was very happy at 23. I found my meaning in life when I became a monk, a purpose, something which I could focus on and dedicate my life to and get lots of fulfillment from. And many of you, you know what it's like. You try this, you try that. You're never really sort of satisfied and happy finding a meaning for your life. But somehow or other, just the focus which a war brings to people, to soldiers, is such a singleness of purpose which they can, with a bit of propaganda, believe in. And they just find a meaning in that time. Because many people who were soldiers, who you talk to, even though you don't agree with wars, I don't personally, it's my personal opinion, but still you have to respect what other people say. And they found some of those war years, some of the most meaningful in their life, where they made friendships, where they had to trust one another because their lives depended upon it. And the intensity of that experience sometimes gave them the most important parts of their life. And I think that intensity of why you join up and what you're fighting for, most people don't really know. They make it up afterwards. But the reason why you're actually in those battles and fighting those wars, it does give you a sense of purpose, a sense of friendship, a sense of looking after one another. And those are the qualities which sometimes you hear old soldiers talking about, where the people they fought with in those wars became their closest of friends, because they had to be. And sometimes on that I say, do we need to have just the trauma and the destruction of a war to create such friendships and such bonds? We should really understand that whether it's in a family, in a community, even in a company, just our success depends on one another. And we should look out for one another, guard one another, and just help one another, support one another, as was essential for survival, in a war. And can we not have that same sense of camaraderie, without the bullets and the guns and the bombs? And sometimes that's really up to you to create that meaning, especially in your family or in a community, where we have some sort of project to give us meaning, work together towards it, and eventually we get there in the end. That is one of the reasons why that sometimes people ask me, in the Buddhist society, why do you always have these new projects? We spent lots of money building a Jhana Grove retreat center where I've just been teaching retreats. It's a beautiful place. Now we're building a nun's monastery, which costs a lot of money. What next? And I say there'll always be something next. And the reason why, because a lot of times that gives our Buddhist community some direction, where we can come together for something, a higher cause, whatever that cause happens to be. Sometimes we need that meaning in life, and sometimes that meaning does need some sort of project, some goal, something inspiring which we can work towards. Whether you work together in the community to try and solve the problem of climate change, whether you try and solve the slavery problem which is here in our world still. Whatever you do, when you can come together and you give it meaning, that is important for us, to actually, it's part of the human experience, to bond, work together, have a goal, to strive towards it, to sacrifice so much for what you believe in and make this world a better place. And so maybe some alternatives, you know, to the fighting in the war. But certainly, you know, you can respect people who sacrifice their own comfort for what they believe in is a higher goal. But the problem is that when we celebrate as something like Anzac Day, it'd be wonderful if we say, well, you know, in a war, as the Buddha kept on saying, there are no victors. You can never say that Australia won the war. No one wins any war at all. And you can't say, look, how many people here are from Germany? Remember that old Monty Python movie? Don't mention the war. Because there was a German staying in this guy's hotel. And there's so many friends, monks. Some of my best friends are from Germany. And Japan. You know, I've got great friends in Japan. I'll be going there over in December, and so will Jake. And they're just so beautiful, such kind, wonderful people we meet over there. You may have married a Japanese girl. So what's wrong with the Japanese? What's wrong with the Germans? Did we beat anybody? No. In a war, you always know everybody loses. And you see that. I've been going to Germany every couple of years to teach a retreat. And this isn't in a big Buddhist temple. And part of the job of Buddhist monks, you know, and it always will be the case, we're great psychologists. And we teach many people the tricks of psychology. And great therapists. And many of the monks and the nuns in this temple in Germany where I visit are spending a large amount of time counseling people. This is around the Frankfurt area. Counseling the grandchildren of people who fought in the Second World War. Those grandchildren, second generation, have got post-traumatic stress disorder. Even though they weren't born in the time of that Second World War, even though even their fathers didn't participate in it, the grandparents did. And the trauma goes down generations. And this is, you know, the wounds of war do not end when the people who fought in it pass away. They keep on going again and again and again, down the generations. And when you actually see that, you feel that, you sit in front of somebody who's going through that, you realize just the effect, you know, of, you know, the violence of war on people. It's something we can, on an Anzac Day, we can respect, you know, the sacrifice and the feeling that there was some meaning in people's lives and the camaraderie, the, you know, the selflessness of many people. But I would like to distinguish from celebrating war, celebrating the people who had to fight in it, but not celebrating a war, and neither celebrating winners. Because I know that just divides us again and again and again. One of the nice developments, because I always try and keep a positive mind, you know, in the development of our human civilization, one of the great developments of the last 10, 20, 30 years, you know, is to see the great movement of people. You know, how many people here were born in Australia? Hey, one, two, three, four. How many Australians are living overseas? How many overseas people are living here? How many people marry someone who wasn't born in Australia? We're mixing up. And that is one of the beautiful hopes we have in our world. That it doesn't matter what country you come from. You know, you can go to most countries in this world, marry whoever you, you know, fall in love with. And you can live in a third country if you want to. And so it really starts to take away this identity, you know, of being an Australian, being Asian, being Sri Lankan, or being whatever. And I have that very strongly. I was born in England, but I lived the last 30 years in Australia. I was 9 years in Thailand. I traveled to so many different countries, and this is actually how I feel. That whenever I say go to, say, Singapore, whenever I land in Changi, all my friends are there to meet me at the airport, I feel I'm coming home. And then I go across the causeway into Malaysia, and I've known so many people in Malaysia, I think, I'm home again. And I like telling this story that in a week's time, just over a week's time, I'll be off in 2 weeks' time in Vietnam for this United Nations Day of Vaisak. The last time I was in Vietnam for that conference, I was coming out of the conference hall and the Malaysian delegation were having their photograph taken. A big Malaysian flag was furled in front of them. And as soon as, it's absolutely true, as soon as they saw me coming out, they say, Ajahn Brahm, come over here. And I said, look, I'm not Malaysian, I'm Australian, or maybe English. I've got two passports. Say, no, 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 you're one of us. Come over here. And I was really honored. And I felt so good of having my photograph taken in the official Malaysian delegation for this conference. And I wasn't Malaysian. Or was I? And then you go over to Thailand. And I was in Thailand for 9 years. I can speak Thai. And I can think Thai. And am I Thai? Whenever you go there, you know, it's like coming home again. You know the language. You know Laos. The northeast of Thailand where Ajahn Chah was basically Laos. You know, it wasn't really Thailand because the culture, the language was Laotian. People, again, they thought Laotian. I love Laotian culture. It's really down to earth. This is Laotian culture. This is how the Laos used to fight their wars. Because I had a mate who was in Luang Prabang, the second city in Laos, during the war. You know, the communists, they called them Pathet Lao, was fighting the government forces. And if there's any Laos here, you recognize this is your culture. And this friend, he was English, and he was in a restaurant. You know, in Asia, the restaurants, they're not like, you know, Fraser's restaurant in King's Park. You know, it's just, you know, bamboo, thatch, you know, but delicious food. Totally contravening every occupational health and safety regulation you find in Australia. But, you know, the food was really yummy. So he was there on a table just having this delicious food. And on the next table, he had the government troops. You know, the royalist troops had their M16 rifles, or whatever they call them, against the bamboo of the wall, having their lunch. And then the communist soldiers came in. Now, these were, they're fighting a war together, okay? The communist soldiers came in, and he went to dive under one of the tables, but he stopped, because the royalists, the government soldiers, they weren't fazed at all. They just carried on eating. And the communists, they just went to another table and had their lunch. And they both, you know, had their lunches, and it was almost by an unspoken agreement. The royalists left first, and the communists counted for 10 or something, and then left afterwards. Because in Laos, wars stop for lunch. Now, it ties, you know, sometimes, you used to be like that, but sometimes, you know, you got too westernized these days. But Laos, they got priorities right. And they made sure they go in different directions so they don't meet each other. They weren't really serious when it came to wars in those days anyway. And so that sort of culture, you know, I love that type of culture where, you know, wars are something, you know, well, maybe you have to do, but, you know, make sure we don't do it seriously. You know, no, we're going over there, okay, so you go and look for us over in the other direction. But, you know, sometimes am I influenced by Laotian culture? Then I go back to UK. I was born there, relations there. I got my original culture there, so I feel I'm going home there. And there's so many places I feel like I'm going home. Then I come back to Australia. Good old Perth. Yes, I'm home again. Now this is, I'm sure many of you feel the same. You've got homes in many different countries. You know, you've got connections to so many different cultures. That's a beautiful thing of our modern world. It makes it less likely that we go to wars with each other. Who are we fighting? I'm fighting the relations of my wife. I'm just fighting a place where I grew up in. How can we go to war with Indonesia when we all go to Bali for holidays and we love the place? What on earth are we doing? Now that's a beautiful start to being able to stop all this war business. So that when we do intermingle, we do live in each other's countries, we do marry people from different races, different religions, different backgrounds, different cultures, There's a sense of mixing everybody up so we cannot be tribalized anymore. And we cannot really start thinking that these people are different than us. Now, one of the monks said earlier that about Anzac Day, the person who asked me the question, he said one of his friends said, no, if we didn't sort of fight in the war, we'd now all be run by the Germans. The economy would probably be much better. What's wrong with the Germans? They're really nice people. They got good food and they've got an excellent soccer team. It might be invaded and run by the Japanese. If we were invaded and run by the Japanese, we'd have far more Buddhist temples. So sometimes we demonize this race or that race. And sometimes that demonization of one race against another race, I mean, that is the stuff which creates wars. I mean, you know this, I know this. You go traveling all over the world, and you know, some of your best friends are Muslims. But you're a Buddhist, Ajahn Brahm. You know, one of my best friends was the abbot of New Norcia Monastery, Abbot Placid. But he's a Catholic, you're a Buddhist. You know, you should be arguing together. Should we? When we can break those barriers between peoples, and we realize there is no such thing as a Sri Lankan, as a Thai, as an Australian, that we're human beings, for goodness sake, first and foremost. And if we're all human beings, just the same family, can't we just learn how to live together and put aside this weapon so we don't need any more Anzac Days ever again? We can actually live in peace and harmony. And it is a job for people like me. Yeah, I'm a Buddhist leader, to try and break down those barriers between other religions. That's why I'm very happy with what I've been doing in Indonesia, especially. The last time I was in Indonesia, she's not here today, but she's at our monastery, Burton Peng. I was just in the airport in Bali, just waiting for a connection. It was a couple of hours. And you wouldn't believe how many people came up to take photos with me. Because my books, they're Open the Door of Your Heart book. That, absolutely true, number one bestseller throughout Indonesia. So I am very well known in Indonesia. Extremely. And it's actually number two, number three were all bestsellers. So you're just sitting in the airport, just having a cup of tea. And all these Muslims come up. Are you Ajahn Brahm? Yeah, can I have a photo with you? And there you are, in hijabs and everything. You're having photographs with their favorite Buddhist. And I love that. And then this guy comes up, he said, I'm a Catholic priest. I tell your stories in my sermons. Can I have a photo with you? That makes me very proud that actually you are breaking down some barriers. So the Catholics and the Buddhists and the Christians and everybody else can at last learn how to live together in a bit of peace and harmony. So we don't need those wars anymore. So whenever we do have an Anzac Day celebration or remembrance or whatever you call it, sometimes as a Buddhist, I think we had that war and this war's going on right now. It makes me even just more determined to try and do whatever I can do to stop any wars in the future. Apparently Tony Abbott said we should take up arms. That's what he said, apparently, you said today. And that is such a stupid comment. With all respect to whatever politics you have, we shouldn't take up arms. We should be trying our best, to put hands of friendship to all types of people and try and make sure we never have to fire those guns ever again. The trouble is that, sometimes, and it's actually an interesting part of our modern cultures, that many of the people in our modern armies, they say that, their roles in the future would be more peacekeepers rather than, warriors fighting people. And indeed, I remember going off to, UK. And if ever you've been traveling in a place like UK, you just travel these beautiful highways and little country roads. And I'm always coming, I don't know why it was with me, I'm always coming across these fenced off areas saying Ministry of Defence. And I commented to people, that's not the ministry of defense, that's the ministry of attack. Because here, you know, you've got, I forget who it is, and the minister in the Australian government, they call them the minister of defense. Now, what spin is that? It's not defense, it's attack. Because it's far too sort of violent. But the idea of being peacekeepers is a very beautiful idea, which can transform, you know, the role of an army to try and keep that peace. And it brings back a time when I was in the UK at this time. They have a far bigger army, obviously, than Australia. And so that they had chaplains in that army. And because it was a huge multicultural society in UK, they had a Buddhist chaplain in the British Army. And that fascinated me, especially when he picked me up from the airport and said, we're having a seminar next week, can you come? I said, for who? He said, for Buddhists in the British Army. And I thought, that's really, there are Buddhists in the British Army, and I thought straight away that these would be, you know, like the dentists or the accountants. You know, we had actually a monk in our monastery some years ago. He used to be a Gurkha. You know, Gurkhas were really, really fierce soldiers. I remember they saying, you know when a Gurkha soldier has been, because you wake up in the morning, you shake your head and it falls off. That's, you know, the Gurkha joke. They're really fierce. And so this guy, you know, he used to be a Gurkha soldier, and even I was a bit scared of him. Until he said, now, what are you doing? Now, did you cut off people's heads in the Gurkha? He said, no, I was an accountant. So even the Gurkhas have to people doing the sums to actually to pay the soldiers. So I thought that in the British Army, the people who were Buddhists would be just the, you know, the dentists, the teachers, and the accountants. But when I went to this seminar, there was, you know, half a dozen of these Buddhists were frontline soldiers who'd been to Iraq. Now, as a Buddhist, straight away, that I thought, first of all, now this is a stupid Buddhist, and I sometimes think stupid. I thought, how on earth can you call yourself a Buddhist when you're going to a war with a gun shooting people? How can you be a Buddhist? But please be careful, because sometimes that, you know, even your particular take on Buddhism, spirituality, or whatever, please don't judge people so quickly. Because I wanted to learn from them. Instead of judging them, say, bad Buddhist, you're shooting people, you should not do that. You can't call yourself a Buddhist because you're in an army. Instead of judging people, listen to them first of all. Instead of judging anyone in this world, especially, you know, those soldiers who were parading this morning in the cities of Australia, don't judge them, you know, they're violent. Or like one soldier friend told me, he said, some of the people he met just called him a murderer because he served in the army. Now, that's not correct and that's not right. You can't judge people that way. So, you know, have a bit of respect for people, but ask them first of all. And I spent this morning basically learning from these British Buddhists how they could serve in the front line of the army in Iraq. And what they were saying to me was actually just mind-opening. He said, look, you know, we just have a very strong commitment to the values of our society. They said, we really do want to preserve them. You know, we don't want, you know, to have, you know, the lack of freedoms, you know, which sometimes some extreme religions will try and take away from you. Now, they do want the freedom, you know, if they really want to go to the pub in the evening and have a beer rather than it being banned. They do want the freedom to be able to tell jokes about all types of religions, you know, instead of being afraid of them. They do want, you know, the freedom to, you know, to think whatever you want and to argue, to come to a temple if you like, to leave it if you want. And they had a certain idea of the values that they wanted to continue in their society. And they were said, well, you know, this is what we are going to that place for. But they said, as Buddhists, we would never, ever shoot to kill a person out of anger. And I asked them, can you do that? And they said, yes, you know, as a Buddhist, we really have to curtail our anger. There's something called a discipline in an army. And that's one thing that when you actually see people who have served in an army, there is a sense of like restraint, and they just cannot just do what they want to do. There's a training there to restrain the emotions of anger, ill will, and that is something which is very impressive. Now, there is a training there, just like you have to train to play a piano, you have to train to play tennis, and that discipline does give you a sense of, you know, you can sort of stop some of the worst parts of human nature. And they said to me that, you know, when they're fighting in a battle, they have to be so careful they'd never shoot out of anger. It's only every time out of defense. And I asked, you know, have you ever not done that? And they said, no, we've only done that. It really is out of defense. And sometimes after I talked with them, I thought, well, quite frankly, I'd rather have Buddhists serving in an army than any other religion, you know, than any other sort of people who haven't got that training in letting go of anger and just being a little bit more compassionate to people. So, you know, that was a little bit of an eye-opener to me. And so that, you know, there we have people, and I know them, and you know, every time I go there, they always find where I am and come and see me. You know, and just, they want to try and make a better world, however they want to do it. I think there may be some better ways to make a better world than serving in an army, but that's what they take on. And maybe, you know, they're trying to do their very best. So sometimes that just, you know, being, say, war is all bad, you shouldn't be a soldier, Buddhism doesn't sort of support the military and stuff like that. Sometimes people say that, and it's just too easy to say, not enough understanding. But, you know, we do have soldiers, we do have navies, we do have armies. Hopefully that they will be in more peacekeeping roles. And maybe Buddhism can help them not sort of give rise to their anger, so they can be restrained, so they don't sort of go and do this incredible bad, basically crimes against humanity, which sometimes happens in wars. But in the meantime, you know, because something like an Anzac Day happens, you know, to respect, you know, the people who actually, you know, had to serve, they didn't really have much choice. And at the same time, you know, as an incentive to try and find some means that we don't have to go to war for offense anymore. Peacekeeping, yes, but offense, no. And that's something which I always thought that Buddhism had a huge amount to give to this world in solving conflicts, simply because, you know, we do have some idea of how to respect people from other races, religions. And we do have great means of resolving conflicts between peoples. Now, we do have this great psychology, understanding the way of the mind. And if you can remember a talk which I gave you a couple of weeks ago, it was a talk called Right Listening, that just the way we listen to one another can solve a huge amount of conflicts in our world. Now, sometimes we have to just open our ears and not prejudge what another person is saying, not assume that we know, but be able to listen to a person and learn a different perspective. And if you can listen with that compassion, non-judgmental, not only are you respecting the other person, but you're actually gaining more wisdom, more understanding. Too often when we listen to another person, we already know what we're going to say to them back. We're not really listening at all. This is one of the reasons why the training which we have in Buddhism, especially to be silent, have a quiet, silent mind, it's amazing what you can pick up when you're quiet, when you're not thinking, when you're just receiving all the information. That is a way of empathy with another person. And when you can listen to another person with empathy, number one, you know, they realize you're respecting them, and straight away that you know you have a much better relationship. How many times is it that you try and speak to someone and they're not listening to you? They don't respect you. They already judged who you are and they're trying to change you, get rid of you, whatever it is. Buddhists are much better than that. I was told someone about one of our monks in England. He was on a train going from one place to another, and this woman came up to him. She was an evangelical Christian. And she thought, wow, if I convert a Buddhist monk, that is double merit for me. So she came along trying to convert this monk. and all the way for about half an hour telling about the wonders of Jesus, and if you're a Buddhist, you go to hell. You know what it is, blah, 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 blah. And all the time he was listening kindly as she was ranting on, and then eventually he came to his stop, and he said to her, he says, I've got to leave now, this is my stop, but I really love you, and have a wonderful day. And just that word, I love you, to this woman, she just stopped. It was like her brain fused. She didn't know. She'd been ranting against this guy for half an hour, and he never got angry once at her. Just as he left, oh, I really love you. Have a great day. And that kindness, was the great way that Buddhists can actually solve these problems if you really got your act together. Don't let people harangue you and make you upset. Just listen and be this empty bucket with a hole in the bottom. They can pour whatever rubbish, into you, and it all goes out. You keep nothing. So when they leave, you've got no anger left. You can just say, I love you, and have a wonderful day, even though they verbally abuse you for such a long time. That's how you stop wars. Because you're respecting one another, and you're being kind to one another. You're being wise. And everybody wants to be respected. And it's that lack of respect, that lack of understanding, the lack of willingness to listen to another person, which causes all the misunderstandings and the conflicts, in our world. So, Buddhism has got something there. The other thing which Buddhism has, which can stop these terrible, terrible wars, is we don't have an idea of revenge. Because that's what happens. People say, your country bombed us, so we've got to bomb you back twice. And you all know just what started the Iraq war, the 9/11. And we all remember that. But what did you do at 9/11? I was giving a talk in Singapore just afterwards. And I remember just at this talk, somebody stood up and said, Ajahn Brahm, if you were George Bush or George W. Bush, what would you do after 9/11? And that was his question to me. I said, look, if I had been George Bush at that time, I'd have gone to TV straight away after 9/11 and said, I don't know who did this. It's very terrible, the loss of life. Hundreds of people have died. And I really feel for the loss and the pain of all the relations and friends of the people who have lost their lives. And for those people who committed this terrible, terrible act, on behalf of all the people of the United States, I forgive you. Enough lives have been lost already. I don't want to take any more lives. When I said that, I got a standing ovation. That was in the Taiping Center in Lavender Road in Singapore. People afterwards, they said, they walked the microphone again and said, Ajahn Brahm, why aren't you the President of the United States? Now imagine that actually happened. What would have been the result? And if a George W. Bush had gone up and say, just what I said to you, that would have been a circuit breaker. And I'm pretty confident, and I think you probably agree with me, that many of the Muslims in the Gaza Strip or in Tehran will be walking down the streets with placards, instead of Osama bin Laden, of George W. Bush. Good on George W. Bush. He would have been a hero in the Muslim world, simply because he took a very high moral stand. And instead of having revenge in his heart, having this incredible forgiveness, who are the great peacemakers of our world? Who are the people who could have started a war but decided another way? Gandhi. Gandhi, with his ragtag army of people in India, he threw out the British Empire at the height of its power without a weapon being sort of fired. And it was incredible what that fellow did. And this was the British Army, my ancestors. They were incredibly powerful after the Second World War. And they had all the armaments and guns, and instead of actually just having an insurgency against the British Raj in India, he just said, one day you'll walk out, and they actually did. There's incredible moral power of non-violence. And then you had Gandhi, Mandela over in South Africa. You know, that was a powder keg of any South Africans. No, it's still not a solved country, and many people think that maybe, you know, that it's gone backwards. You know, many South Africans have come to Perth, but you know, without that fellow, that would have been so much violence in that country. These are solving world problems, you know, without resorting to wars. And those were not Buddhists, Aung San Suu Kyi. But let's go even earlier back, because this is a story I talked about in Open the Door of Your Heart. And I had to put it in here because it has not been told and it deserves to be told. You know, for once a Buddhist government actually did Buddhist things and solved a huge problem. And that was in my time when I was in Thailand. And it's a beautiful story which shows there is another way when there's a really big insurgency in your country. I was in Thailand at the end of the Vietnam War, Saigon, Phnom Penh, and Vientiane, the capital of Laos, all fell within days of one another. And where I was in Ubon, in northeast Thailand, the distance from Ubon to Bangkok was twice the distance as it was to Hanoi. Hanoi was so much closer to where I was. And the Western governments contacted all the Western monks in this monastery, Ajahn Chah's monastery, and told us to be prepared. Basically, they expected the Viet Cong to come into the northeast of Thailand and take that. It was called the domino theory. And any time they could invade, and basically that we were so close to Hanoi, we wouldn't have much of a chance. Now, at that time, I was fluent in Thai and Lao, and my master, Ajahn Chah, was quite famous. So we had generals coming up to talk with Ajahn Chah, and I was there listening to them. And these were people in power who knew what was going on, and they said quite openly, Viet Cong are not going to invade Thailand. They've used up all their resources in the war so far. They just haven't got any resources left to invade our country. But what we are afraid of, he said, and serious fear, was the Thai students who had fled their university because they were upset at the governments and were living in the jungles, in the mountains, getting all of their training and arms from across the border, from the Viet Cong, the Pathet Lao, the Khmer Rouge, getting all the training and armaments and support from there and fighting an internal war against Thailand. There were many what they called pink areas of Thailand at that time where the communists had control of the country. And I was there at the time. I had to know where those pink areas were, because if I wandered into those pink areas, I would have been killed. I was a monk, but they would say, you know, even though I was English, they would say CIA. I was a spy. And they would kill you straight away, usually torture. Many monks were actually tortured and killed by these communists at that time. And many soldiers had been killed as well. And it was for many years, it was actually touch and go whether the insurgents would actually win. Ask any Thai at the time. But the Thai government at that time, at last, a government solved a problem with Buddhist ways. What they did was, number one, non-violence. I knew the soldiers, I knew the generals, and I said, no, you know where, because I was wandering here and I'd actually have to check in with the local army post, you know, in their bunkers, you know, because they were attacked. And I'd ask them, now I want to go off and meditate. Can I go to that hill over there? They'd say, no, don't go there. That's where the communists are. That hill over there is free. You can go over there. There's some nice caves there. You can meditate. And that's actually what I did. I had to check in with them because they knew where the communists were and I would be killed if I went to the wrong places. And then I said, well, you know where they are. Why didn't you attack them? He said, no, we're not attacking. Because they knew if you kill one of the insurgents, you know, their friends, their brothers, they would join. You get two to fight instead. There was absolute non-violence. Even though the Thai army had helicopter gunships and stuff that they got from the United States, they could have done a lot of damage, but they did not. It was total non-violence. And there was also amnesty. Total forgiveness, no revenge. So any time any one of those soldiers, those insurgents, gave themselves up, they weren't interrogated, they weren't beaten, they weren't put in jail, they weren't put against the wall and shot. They said, okay, back you go to your village or your university. No questions asked amnesty. And I know this because I saw it happen. And lastly, it was, why are you fighting? Now, what's wrong? What's the problem? They listened to the insurgents, and most of the problem was unequal distribution of wealth. The poor areas, you know, Bangkok and the big cities were doing well. The poor areas, especially of the northeast, were really suffering. So what happened? The government and the king of Thailand put in especially very smart irrigation projects to actually so the farmers could get two crops a year instead of one crop, electricity, so you could have schools and medical facilities, because in many of these places there was nothing. It was really backwards. So the villages on which the insurgents depended for their rice and other food, they started to like their government. And they became prosperous. I remember one soldier who told me, now I was speaking to him in Thai, just chewing the fat, and he said, yeah, they're just up there, you know, that's where the camp is. And they come down to get some rice every now and again. I know who they are. I just wish them, you know, good day. You know, how are you going? Bye nai. He's, where are you going? Saying hello. And I know who they are, and I don't fight them. But what I do, he said, I show them my new watch I just bought. I just show them the new radio I just got. And he said, I just show them we're getting prosperous. And that was all they needed to do. One by one, those insurgents gave themselves up. There's nothing to fight for anymore. Until the day came that there was hardly any insurgents left, and the leaders gave themselves up. And when those leaders gave themselves up, these were the ones who were trying to overthrow the government of Thailand. Now, what would most people do with those leaders? Again, shoot them, put them in trial. Because, you know, they were responsible for many people being killed. But what the Thai government did, amnesty, but with a bit more. Not only did they forgive these generals of these communist insurgents, they appointed them immediately to good positions in the Thai civil service. They said, you have incredible motivation, organizational skills, self-sacrifice. We do not want to waste your good qualities by shooting you or putting in jail to rot. And they got immediately put in good positions in the government. And I told that story in Sydney once, and it was the Thai consul in Sydney stood up and he said, I want to add some moral to your story. It is absolutely true, he said, I know that. But he said also, right now, this was maybe 10 years ago, he said, three of those insurgent leaders, the ones which any other country would have shot or put in jail for years, three of those leaders are currently serving as ministers in the Thai government. Imagine that. So if I was George W. Bush and I did capture alive Osama bin Laden, I'd use his resources, come on, work for us. You make him treasurer, he's got lots of money. Now that's a Buddhist way of doing things. You know, you bring people inside rather than killing them, putting them in jail or doing whatever. Many of these people are highly motivated, come and join us rather than being our enemies. And that was what solved an insurgency in Thailand in the 70s and 80s. And it was a brilliant, which needs to be mentioned to people. You don't always have to fight wars. You don't have to send in the army against the Taliban. And who wins? You know, isn't there another way? They always say, and this is in the Chinese art of war, it doesn't matter if you've got superior forces, superior armament, superior money, it's the ones who are superior motivated are the ones who will win. It's your motivation. That is what always will win against any sort of huge amounts of arms, weapons, or money. And it's that motivation, just, you know, you've got something really important, you know, you want to inspire you. And there's no reason why we can't just get something which is inspiring everybody for a much more peaceful, harmonious, good world. So if we have that inspiration and spread that inspiration, spread the goodness of, you know, what basically every Muslim would want. You know, in Afghanistan, some peace, some harmony, some freedom, some fairness, be able to go about their jobs and be able to have children and have their children safe. If we can only just basically remember what most people want and allow that to happen, and don't sort of think that Australians are superior to the New Zealanders or or whatever. No one's superior to anyone. No race is better than anybody. So let's take away that superiority and just, can we please, you know, have an end of wars and have some reconciliation? No revenge, please. That's why I never agree with any war crimes tribunal. I'm sorry, but that just keeps the wounds open. If you're a Christian, a Muslim, God will solve the problems of revenge. If you're a Buddhist, karma will get you. And we can forgive and just let these other processes, you know, solve the problem of so-called, you know, reward and punishment. But the job of human beings is to forgive for the sake of our children and for the sake of the future of this planet. If we're always seeking an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, we're always seeking revenge, because you hurt me, I have to hurt you, that is totally endless. And we'll keep going on destroying our planet. And we'll have so many more memorials to the dead of wars. And a lot of times people don't know why they were fought. So can we please remember this? And Buddhism has a lot to give for this. That's one of the reasons I think I mentioned this earlier in the talk I gave in Jhanagrove. Can more of you who are Buddhist put your hand up and stand for governments? I don't care what party you stand for. So you can actually put some of these Buddhist principles in the places where they can be effective. So that we don't have to have politicians saying we should all take up arms, you know, just because, you know, we do respect people who had to go to wars and had to go through hell and see so much pain and suffering, which, you know, we don't ever have to see. Can we make sure that never happens again? And that is, I think, how we should respect the people who died from all sides in all wars. So that's my Buddhist reflections on Anzac Day. Thank you. Okay, I'm sorry there's no jokes today, but it's a sort of subject which is really hard to get a joke in, and it's disrespectful. But anyway, please, any comments or questions? I hope I did the subject, you know, some good, some worse, but it's such a difficult, sensitive subject. And I apologize if I offended anybody. Yeah.
I was thinking, you talked about like warriors and Buddhism, about the Shaolin.
The Shaolin and those warriors. Again, the whole idea of a warrior just is counter to what I ever understood as Buddhism. Unfortunately, like anything else, sometimes Buddhism can get corrupted. It's okay if you'd use it as an exercise, you know, to get fit. But actually to hit somebody, you know, is that anything to do with Buddhism? For those of you who don't know this, you may have seen in Zen tradition that when somebody is meditating, you fall asleep, they hit you on the back with a stick. That's not Buddhism at all, unfortunately. But when I was in Hong Kong about 18 months ago, and you know, there was a Chinese monk, and just having breakfast together, talking about this, that, and the other. And he said an interesting thing happened in mainland China a week before. A monk was teaching a meditation retreat. And he was a Zen monk. And one of the ladies trying to meditate was nodding, falling asleep. So he used a Zen stick and he hit her on the back. That's tradition. But things have changed in China. She got out her cell phone, immediately called the police, and had him arrested. And the monk was taken to jail. It may be tradition, but you can't do that in the modern world. And fair enough, it's violence. You've got to be careful what you do. So that's even violence. I mean, what message is it giving to people in Buddhism? You know, when you have a sort of person with a stick hitting people, even if you think it's for the best motives, you're giving a wrong message. So please, that's a different talk than I usually give. It's not really all that uplifting, but I hope it may be uplifting. Gives you hope and addresses an issue in the world which, you know, I find very troublesome as well. You know, because you know people who fought in the war, you respect them, and they did a very difficult thing. But you know, can we use the opportunity to try and have no more wars? So one thing you can do is, no matter wherever you were born, say you were born in Australia, please marry someone who's from another country. And number two, from another religion, and when you have a kid, see if you can have 4 or 5 kids and have one Buddhist, one Hindu, one Christian, one Jew, and one Muslim. Have the full set. And to make a statement that we can live together in peace and harmony. Yeah? I used to have. Yeah, oh gee. Yeah, okay. I agree. When we have trouble with monks trying to get sort of visas. But you know that some years ago, you know, I had more contacts with the Labour government before. And, you know, the local member for Perth, John Hyde, he's a great friend of CIFAR over there, would have come to all the Thai events. And when there was a problem, he said, I'll fix it. And I had a meeting with Chris Evans, who was the minister. If you can only get to the top guys, and they're just so easy to talk with. Oh, yeah, I can see the problem there. Yeah, no worries. Some of the problems is with, you know, what we call bureaucracy. Because when there are too many rules and regulations, people are so scared of using their common sense. And they just say, well, it says you can't do this. But this is stupid. But it says in the rules. But, and unfortunately, they're so scared of actually using their common sense and kindness, they reject your visas. And that's one of the problems with bureaucracies and people who are too scared to do what they know in their heart is right. Exactly. And look, it's supposed to be representing the government, the people rather, of Australia. And, you know, if you put your case on the internet and had a vote, you know, from the people of Australia, 90% would say, oh, yeah, let them in. But unfortunately, our government doesn't follow the... No, governments don't do that. They can't hear the will of the people. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. It's sometimes... And it's a lot of times because people, they cheat the system. And because a few people cheat, then everyone has to suffer. You know, there was one of our members died about a year ago, and he made me the executor of his will. Please never do that to me, because I haven't got a clue. And then, you know, apparently I have to do his tax return. And I'm a monk, I don't know how to do this. But fortunately, you know, there's many members here, and there's one member, he's an old ex-accountant. You know, he did the tax return for me, but he showed it to me. I signed it in the end. And I really feel sad for you. It's a whole book you have to sign. And how you can work out what that means, you're much more clever than I am. I would never be able to figure that out, tax returns. Crikey, why do you have such a big, thick book? It's because everyone is trying to cheat. That's why. So wouldn't it be nice? Because one of the things I say as Buddhist, if you keep your 5 precepts, which means you're a full member of this joint, you have to fill in your tax returns accurately and honestly. So I really think there should be special tax returns for Buddhists who keep five precepts. Simple. You just say how much you earn and they've accepted it straight away. Because you're not going to lie, and they can trust you. Yeah, this is a Buddhist. Okay, you don't have to fill out all these other forms. This is specially for Buddhists because you're honest. There we go. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And a lot of rules are because you can't trust people. And immigration rules are the same. Too many people have cheated and lied, which means that, you know, you've got a good reason and it's like hell trying to get it through. Anyway, yeah. And anyway, why can't you have people coming in and out of Australia? How many Australians go and live in Indonesia? And how many Indonesians can come and live in Australia? It's a bit unfair, isn't it? Okay, I'm getting political. I better get out of this. Okay, yeah, go on.
Seeing as we're talking about interrelationships between countries,
yeah.
I'm Australian and I'm married to somebody from Brazil.
What's
your Buddhist advice for communication between cultures?
Brazil, I mean, it's the best coffee in the world. And got a great football team too. Yeah, I mean, there's another person who comes here. I don't know, he's not really married, but he's had a long-term relationship with a Brazilian girl. She comes here, goes on the retreats, and he goes over there very often. What do you mean, different culture?
Just miscommunication between languages and cultures. So one person may be saying one thing and the other person hears something else simply because of their cultural background. Yep.
Yeah, because after a while, you know, you actually start to think in Brazilian culture. And it's so amazing. I had to start thinking in Thai culture. I wasn't speaking Thai. I was actually thinking in Thai. And it was a totally different perceptions. You know, like, you know, you're a girl, so I'd call you ma'am, sort of, in English, and you call me sir, say. But that's not the way it works in Thailand. You know, because I'm a ma'am, I call you sir. And because you're a girl, you call me ma'am. So as a girl, you call everybody, you know, ma'am, and boys and girls, because it's saying who you are, not who the person you're speaking is.
Yeah, it's the same in Portuguese.
A simple thing like that.
Yeah.
It was really confusing at first. I thought, this is really interesting. It's a totally different concept. And there's all these different ideas and concepts. And that is really helpful when you can think in a different culture. And it shows you the limitations of, you know, your culture when you can actually accept another culture. And it's much more beautiful. You're richer, your partner's richer for what you learn together. Yeah, misunderstandings, but it's worth it. And once you really understand each other, it's so much better.
Thank you.
Does that make sense to you? But you can't improve upon, this was absolutely true. I haven't seen them for a while. When I first came here, after about 4 or 5 years, I met this Thai girl who was married to an Australian man. And I'm not joking, the Thai girl could not speak a word of English. The Australian man could not speak a word of Thai. They could not understand what anyone said, but they loved each other and they were so happy together. Now you make of that what you want, but it's interesting. I don't know where they've gone these days. I think that they probably, she learned some English and that's probably why they're separated. I don't know. Okay. So any other questions before we finish off tonight? Okay. Thank you for allowing me to say a few funny things because it was a bit too serious even for me tonight. So anyway, I hope it was useful for you and gives a more of an important, useful reflection on this day, Anzac Day. So let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can go and have whatever we need to do.